From KTOO in Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea with this news. The House impeachment inquiry into President Donald Trump is spreading across issues, across the Capitol, and through a new ad campaign all the way to Alaska. A national advocacy group is leveraging the issue in social media ads aimed at Alaskans. The ads are intended to drum up constituent messages to Senator Lisa Murkowski, asking that she vote no on a Trump judicial nominee next week. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin explains why the group connects that to the impeachment inquiry.
The vote is about whether to confirm Stephen Menashe to a federal appellate court in New York. But Christopher Kang of the liberal group Demand Justice says this will essentially be Murkowski's first vote on the Ukraine scandal. That's because Menashe works at the White House counsel's office, and he won't say whether he was involved in the issues at the heart of the impeachment inquiry, that phone call between Trump and the president of Ukraine.
I think that if he had any role in covering up President Trump's impeachable offenses, he certainly should not be a judge trying to rule on the rule of law every day.
Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee sent Menashe a letter more than a month ago asking whether he was involved in moving the record of the call to a classified computer or handling the whistleblower complaint that kicked off the impeachment inquiry. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont says Menashe ignored the questions.
He didn't cite a privilege. He didn't even provide the courtesy of responding.
Democrats have other complaints about Menashe. They say he wrote controversial things in college. Even Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina says Menashe was not very forthcoming with the committee.
And he's written some really weird stuff.
But Graham says what Democrats are really holding against him is that he's a Trump administration lawyer and he has advocated for policies Democrats don't like. The American Bar Association rated Menashe well qualified. The Demand Justice social media ad campaign is narrowly focused on Menashe's silence about his ties, if any, to the Ukraine scandal. Kang, who worked on judicial nominations in the Obama White House, says it's unusual for a nominee to avoid written questions entirely.
Actually, I expected him to answer fairly quickly and to have very clear answers. And the fact that he's been unable to or refused to answer really leads us to conclude that he may have had something to do with this.
Murkowski hasn't announced how she'll vote on Menashe. Her spokeswoman says she's looking into him, as she does with every nominee. Advocacy groups on the left often target her because she is one of the Republican senators most likely to break from her party. But Murkowski has a near-perfect record of voting to confirm Trump's judicial nominees, with one major exception, Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Juneau's seasonal cold weather emergency shelter reopens this weekend, offering a warm alternative to sleeping outside this winter. City demolished the downtown building where the shelter operated last winter. St. Vincent de Paul helped run a shelter and has now taken over operation. The new shelter is in the charity's community center near the Nugget Mall. General Manager Brad Perkins says the new facility will have at least 28 beds and operate from 11 p.m. to about 7 a.m. It will open when the temperature is expected to be at or below freezing.
We take anybody. And so if you are, using or you are drinking, you can come into this shelter. Some people are trespassed out of other places, not just the Glory Hall, but other places, and they cannot come in. You can come in here.
The shelter will be open both Saturday and Sunday. St. Vincent's will post on Twitter and its website 2 to 3 days in advance when the shelter will be open. Light up signs at City Hall, Polaris House, Resurrection Lutheran Church, and the St. Vincent's thrift store also let people know when the shelter will be open. St. Vincent's will run a free overnight shuttle until about 2 a.m. to bring patrons to the shelter. Van will make stops between the Valley, Lemon Creek, and downtown at city bus stops. St. Vincent's recently partnered with Capital City Fire Rescue to run a sobering center on the property. It already has a transitional housing facility, food pantry, and secondhand item depot on site. Community navigators are also available to help connect people to services. Perkins says having the sobering center and the emergency shelter in the same place will help St. Vincent's fulfill its mission to help those in need.
If they need clothing out of the clothing area we have there for people that are there, we'll give them clothing right then. If they need food out of the food pantry, we'll do that. You know, if they need to talk to a navigator, we'll set them up to come back and do that. So this is all exactly what we already do. It fits right in with our mission.
The chancellor of the University of Alaska Southeast plans to retire in June. University of Alaska System, in a release, says the search for Rick Caulfield's successor will begin immediately. A successor is expected to take over in July. Caulfield was appointed chancellor in 2015, but previously worked as a faculty member, professor, and provost within the university system. He and his wife plan to remain in Juneau after he retires. Anchorage has been awarded a $25 million federal grant to assist with upgrades to the Port of Alaska. News organizations reported the funds will be put toward the $2 billion modernization project. Officials say the U.S. Department of Transportation grant will fund construction of a new $214 million petroleum and cement terminal. Mayor Ethan Berkowitz's office says state and federal funds cover $134 million of the terminal's cost, leaving an $80 million gap. Municipal manager Bill Falsey says the grant will help offset the deficit, while the remaining $55 million can be generated from port tariffs. Falsey says the grant will allow the terminal project to start this summer, with completion projected for 2021. An estimated 85% of Alaska's homes and businesses rely on cargo from the port. A prominent Native American rights attorney, author, and activist is in Juneau this week. Walter Echo Hawk stopped into the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute on Thursday to talk about the factors leading to the Tiitun Tlingit people losing a land rights case in the Supreme Court in 1955. Some people in the audience said that the same attitudes that led to that decision are still around today. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney went to hear more about Tiitun versus the United States and has this story.
We saw that in the World War II era Supreme Court decision, the Korematsu case.
Walter Echo Hawk is essentially a walking law library, and it makes sense given that he's been practicing law since 1973.
After all, the jurist Oliver Wendell Holmes said, this is a court of law, young man, not a court of justice.
Echo Hawk spent a lot of time talking about justice and who has access to it. And he used a case that he calls one of the greatest miscarriages of justice in Indian law. Echo Hawk laid out the facts of that case for about 60 people in the Shookahet Clan House. Essentially, Tlingit land was taken to create the Tongass National Forest. Then in 1951, the Forest Service offered up about 350,000 acres of that land for a timber sale near Wrangell. That land is home to the Tiitun Tlingit, and they sued. Echo Hawk calls it a test case, one that was designed to determine the extent of Tlingit land rights in Alaska. In this case, the Tlingit said they had Aboriginal title to the land.
And they said it's just as valid as any white man's ordinary real estate title is.
The Tlingit contended that the timber sale was unconstitutional because their property could not be taken by the government without their consent and without compensation. But that case didn't end well for them. In 1955, the Supreme Court ruled that Congress gave them permission to occupy their homelands, but not title to it. So they had no basis for a claim that the government owed them money. And Echo Hawk laid out a few reasons why this happened, including racism and ignorance. And he also said that the 1950s was not a good time in the country to be bringing up these cases for Native American and Alaska Native people.
This was when the cowboy and Indian movies reigned supreme. All Americans thought they were cowpokes riding in the Wild West.
Federal policy at the time revolved around erasing Alaska Native and American Indian culture.
Given all of these factors, the Supreme Court could hardly be expected to come down with a favorable decision in this case for the Tlingit.
Catherine Eldemar has some thoughts on that last point. She's a lawyer and a judge, and is on the board of directors of the Juneau-based Native corporation, Goldbelt. One thing she suggested, get the judges out of their chambers and into Indian country.
They need to see where their decisions are being implemented and the outcomes. See the poverty, see the challenges, and see how it does not work.
Echo Hawk agreed with her. He says the lack of education among the judges and policymakers is probably the biggest single issue facing Indian country today. But he also said that there's a different mindset now than there was in 1955, that this is the dawn of a brand new era in federal Indian law, a human rights era. He points to the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. It was ratified in the U.S. about a decade ago. And he says that UN framework could be used as the basis for legal arguments framing Indigenous rights as human rights. That was an argument that Rosita Worrell took to heart. Worrell is the president of the Sea Alaska Heritage Institute. She says Southeast Alaska Native people have appealed to the UN before during a fight for their subsistence rights. And at the time, she didn't really see a way for the UN to help them. But now?
But here, we have this proclamation, and it sets out a framework for justice for Native indigenous people.
Wuerl says she's read the proclamation, but hadn't thought about the next step of pushing for the state and federal government to implement those recommendations into law.
So I'm going to go back and take another look at them.
Still, she sees echoes of the same arguments used to justify keeping Tlingit people from owning their land in that 1955 Supreme Court case, used in cases facing Southeast Alaska Native people today. She points to Alaska Native Vietnam veterans who are newly eligible for land claims, but they can't select land near their homes in the Tongass National Forest, which she says is an injustice. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Monday is Veterans Day. In Juneau, John Cooper commands Auk Bay Post 25 of the American Legion. Cooper was active duty in the Air Force in the Vietnam era. He says the Legion advocates for veterans' issues, provides a place for vets to get together and talk, and helps connect them with services. And on Monday, they'll host a ceremony at Centennial Hall honoring veterans. Cooper shared some advice for how to observe the holiday.
You're a member of any military organization, Alaska Native Vets, Military Order of the Purple Heart, DAV, any of those organizations that require you to be a veteran, wear your headgear and show off that you're proud of what you are.
For non-vets, Cooper suggests showing up at some events to show support to vets and their families and to thank them for their service. In addition to the ceremony at Centennial Hall, there are several other events coming up. They're listed at ktoo.org. And finally, we have a correction to a story we aired in this newscast Thursday about the investigation into a 2018 plane crash on Prince of Wales Island. The story conflated the number of fatal and non-fatal float plane crashes in the Ketchikan area this past summer. There were 3 fatal crashes and a 4th without fatalities. And the National Weather Service has a high wind warning in effect from 6 p.m. this evening to 3 p.m. Saturday for the Juneau and Northern Admiralty Island. Weather Service says to expect northeast winds 30 to 40 miles per hour with gusts of 60 to 70 miles per hour. This is specifically for downtown Juneau, Douglas, and Thane. Wind gusts will increase through Friday evening, peaking around midnight. That's it for the KTOO News Update for Friday, November 8th, 2019. I'm Jeremy Shea. Thanks for listening.